WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, political correctness in our art and culture. We talk with Robert Hughes, art critic for Time magazine. He wrote a recent cover story on the fraying of America, the culture of complaint. Also today, we talk with German filmmaker Volker Schlondorf about his new film Voyager, starring Sam Shepard. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new album of flute music by the French composer Charles Coughlin, performed by Fenwick Smith of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The three Democratic presidential candidates, Jerry Brown, Bill Clinton, and Paul Tsongas, are making a last-minute blitz of Michigan and Illinois today, the two states with primaries tomorrow. Clinton, the perceived frontrunner in both states, is busy countering conflict of interest charges relating to his wife, Hillary, whose law firm in Arkansas is involved in state business. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The Clinton campaign, which hits more than a dozen cities today heading into the Midwestern primaries, is firing a few shots back at former California Governor Jerry Brown. Brown blasted Clinton in the debate last night, raising a Washington Post story which alluded to the possible conflict of interest. "You can't escape it," Brown said. "This is the scandal of the week." Speaking to reporters this morning, Hillary Clinton said she did nothing inappropriate and has turned down hundreds of thousands of dollars because of ethical considerations. The Clinton campaign fought back today, passing out magazine articles in which Jerry Brown called for a free trade zone between the U.S. and Mexico. Brown has made his opposition to a Mexico free trade agreement the cornerstone of his Midwestern campaign. Clinton campaign aides say the counterattack was launched because Brown crossed the line last night, but it could be because Brown is gaining ground in Michigan. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Detroit.
Armenia's foreign minister said today that his government will ask the Commonwealth of Independent States to send peacekeeping troops to help end the fighting in Nagorno-Karabakh. He said Armenia will make the request at Friday's summit meeting of the 11 CIS states, which include Armenia and Azerbaijan. Foreign Minister Rafi Hovhannissian said that the problem of Nagorno-Karabakh was a legacy of the former Soviet Union and that the CIS should be willing to solve it. Nagorno-Karabakh is an enclave populated mostly by ethnic Armenians, but it's located inside the borders of Azerbaijan. The Bush administration denied today that it's trying to undermine relations with Israel by leaking allegations about the illegal sale of U.S. arms technology. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
A spokesman for the White House, Marlon Fitzwater, was responding to suggestions that the administration has deliberately leaked information related to Israel's alleged sale of the Patriot missile system to China. Fitzwater said, "No, that's not true. We want good relations with Israel." The spokesman acknowledged that relations have been strained as a result of the dispute over Israel's request for $10 billion in loan guarantees for resettling Soviet Jews. Israel denied the reports, which Deputy Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday described as slander. The Israeli official said the allegations were an obvious campaign aimed at denigrating Israel and sabotaging its relations with the United States. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained about half a point to close at 3,236.36. Declines led advances by a slight margin in moderate trading. This is NPR News. In South Africa, the tension remains high on the eve of the whites-only referendum on constitutional reform. One man's been killed and a woman seriously injured in a bomb attack in the eastern Transvaal, an attack believed to have been carried out by right-wing extremists. Meanwhile, the continuing township violence has prompted African National Congress President Nelson Mandela to ask for an urgent meeting with the government. The BBC's Fergal Keane reports.
The dominant image of the day was of army troop carriers trundling along the dusty township streets, watched in silence by residents who were enduring yet another round of South Africa's township wars. Driving through side streets near the Meadowlands Hostel, I found several which had been blocked off with barricades constructed from rocks. Young ANC comrades manning the barricades told me they were worried about attacks by Inkatha from the hostel, which is about 100 yards away. The most worrying development of the day had to be, however, the right-wing bomb attack in the eastern Transvaal. A gardener at the home of a teacher involved in multiracial schooling was killed when a device exploded in the driveway. The attack confirms fears that extremists in the right-wing alliance are moving into a new phase of provocative terrorist action.
The BBC's Fergal Keane. Two new surveys by Dun & Bradstreet indicate that manufacturing and construction executives are feeling more optimistic about business conditions, at least for the near term. The business research company conducted two separate surveys last month, asking executives from both industries about their expectations for March, April, and May. DNB reported that for the third month in a row, manufacturing executives said they expect increases in production and new orders over the next 3 months. Construction executives were also more confident, expecting more business as businesses and consumers take advantage of low interest rates. Most of the employers surveyed said they expected employment to make a modest increase in the next few months. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Robert Hughes has been called the most controversial art critic in America, and the best. He's also probably one of the most widely read by virtue of writing for Time magazine. Hughes has been venturing beyond the art world. His book, The Fatal Shore, was a history of Australia, his native country. His new book, Barcelona, is a history of the Spanish metropolis. Last month, Hughes wrote a Time magazine cover story headlined The Fraying of America, a scorching look at political correctness, social breakdown, and the culture of complaint. He writes that America has always been multicultural, but today cultural demagogues like Jesse Helms insist there is only one single path for virtuous Americans. On the opposite end, pushers of political correctness are obsessed with victimization, the victims being nearly everyone who is into heterosexual middle-class white male. In this worldview, Hughes writes, only the victim is hero. So now even white American men want victim status too. We even have a rise of cult therapies claiming we are all victims of our parents.
This country was founded upon a kind of utopian myth, the idea that you really could start over again, you really could start fresh, and that the world had been made new and it would be a better world and better for all of those who lived there. Now, of course, as we know, this turned out, although it's one of the sort of great animating myths of America, this promise of American democracy turns out not to have been, you know, not to have worked out all that perfectly. And so consequently, out of this arises a sweeping tendency to continuously blame others for your misfortunes. Now, I'm not talking about, you know, when I'm talking about cultures of complaint, I'm not talking about, really, people who have every cause for dissatisfaction. I'm not, for instance, talking about blacks. What I'm talking more about is the kind of propensity for blaming daddy or mummy that has arisen with the, you know, with the 12-step programs, the various kinds of passing of the blame on dissatisfaction that happened, mainly with the, you know, the American upper middle class.
So you see the recovery movements as fitting into the culture of complaint?
Oh, absolutely, because the basis of the recovery movements, like the basis of Alcoholics Anonymous, is that you can never be regarded as having actually recovered.
It might be inappropriate for me to bring this up, but I know you gave up drinking a couple of years ago, and I was wondering if you were at all a part of the recovery movement.
Good God,
and
no, of course not.
If that influenced your thinking on this, or if you intentionally stayed away from it because you found it offensive.
No, my liver was swelling up, and my doctor said give up drinking or else, so I gave up drinking.
Without the help of 12-step programs?
No, absolutely. You do it yourself.
So you wouldn't want to join or be part of that or anything?
I don't see the point.
Yeah.
I mean, if you could do it yourself, you do it yourself.
Now, let me get back to...
I'm not a very social animal. I mean, my idea of a productive time is not basically sitting around in, you know, in a room with a whole lot of other people. It's, you know, doing it yourself and getting on with your life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't deny that others helped me, mainly my wife.
Mm-hmm.
But I was never, you know, in any real sense of the word, an alcoholic. But, well, of course, that's what all alkies say.
That's what they all say, yeah.
That's what they all say. But I really do not believe that I was. You know, I certainly didn't feel dependent upon the booze in order to get on with working or anything else in my life. But I tell you, it's colossally improved it since I gave it up. I mean, it no hangovers, and I could easily get up at 6 a.m. and get on with my work. It's wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Let me get to the idea of artist as victim, because you're seeing a trend of that where an artist victimization becomes part of their credential for creating good art.
Well, I don't think that that's true. And actually, that's not quite what I say in the essay. Still less in the much longer lectures of which the essay is a condensation. But what does perturb me, I have to say, is the general attack upon the reality of the idea of quality in the visual arts. What we have now is, you know, in some quarters, I would certainly not say in all, is this kind of dissolving, diluting kind of assumption that that almost any work of art, if it is made by a black, a gay, a woman, and all the various subdivisions thereof, because it emanates from a notionally victimized subgroup, is therefore worthy of sympathetic inspection to a greater degree than one which is made by a white male, or one which emanates from a culture dominated historically by the work of white males. Now, I don't think this is necessarily true at all. I mean, I think that it is very good that we have come to look more attentively at the work of blacks, Hispanics, women, and so on and so forth. I mean, I would say that there is, to all intents and purposes, no discrimination against women institutionally in the art world that I know, any more than there's any serious discrimination against women writers in the publishing world. But the problem that I have to look at every day, as a, you know, every working day as a critic, doesn't have to do with that. It's about how do you go about judging the merits of a work of art? How do you argue that such and such a work of art has merits? And it's simply a passing of the buck, an evasion of the fact that we do, in fact, discriminate aesthetically every day, to say that because so many of our references in the history of art are to the work of male painters and generally and sculptors and generally European ones, that therefore, because there is a sexual bias here, that this invalidates the quality of the work. I don't believe that for a second.
Now, you're saying that there's no discrimination against women in the art
world. I'd say there's no significant institutional discrimination against women in the art world anymore. The problem that we have is that there are too many artists.
Right. I just want to underscore the you mean anymore. I mean, just a few years ago,
there certainly
that
was.
That would have been very different.
There certainly was. There was a strong tendency not to take the work of women artists seriously, and this has changed immeasurably in my, certainly in the 20 years that I've been in America. It's not as though before the women's movement turned its attention to the visual arts, there weren't women artists who were taken seriously, but there were certainly not enough of them who were granted equal seriousness.
Do you think the issue of political correctness is entering into the content of the arts?
Oh, sure it is. Yeah, it comes in everywhere. It comes in the... you see, the trouble is that the institutional framework of the arts is under attack from two directions, both from the patriotically correct and from the politically correct. Frankly, I'm much more worried about the patriotically correct than the politically correct, because in some measure, even though their motives spring from a kind of deranged and distorted archaic American Puritanism, the politically correct are to some extent on the side of the, you know, if there are any angels left, some of them are on the side of the angels in a way which could never be claimed for people like Donald Wildman and Pat Buchanan, who are trying to repress things from the other side. But you see, for instance, I find, you know, when that colossal imbroglio went on over Mapplethorpe's photographs, the ones in the X portfolio depicting scenes of sexual torture, although I am a First Amendment fundamentalist, and although I would absolutely defend the right to show Mapplethorpe's pictures in a, you know, provided that, you know, kids didn't get to see them accidentally, let's say, you know, in other words, under controlled museum or gallery conditions. The thing that I did rather resent was the way in which suddenly the whole art world felt stampeded by the persecution and assassination of Robert Mapplethorpe by Jesse Helms into regarding him as this absolutely inviolate icon of gay sensibility, so that even if you said that you know, let's say, if you said, as I quite frankly believe, that he's a pretty minor photographer, that this would instantly be taken as a homophobic utterance. That's the sort of thing that I think muddies the waters.
Well, I want to ask you about some of the art that people on the
extreme right have found not only shocking but repulsive
and
repugnant.
Which has caused this tremendous Philistine attack on the National Endowment for the Arts. I think the merits of their work, the quality of their work, varies very widely. I mean, for instance, Andres Serrano, I think, is an extremely serious artist, and I take his work very seriously indeed. And indeed, you know, that famous photographic image of his of the plastic crucifix submerged in urine called Piss Christ, I think is a, you know, speaking as an ex-Catholic, which I gather he is too, I take that to be actually a serious religious work of art. It is an utterance about what has happened to religious mystery and to authentic religious feeling at the hands of its increasing commercialization, politicization, and making blatant by you know, the sort of tenor of American life, including the fundamentalists themselves. But you see, when, for instance, I went to see the work of another artist who, you know, greatly scandalizes the Helmses and Wildmans of this world, namely Karen Findlay, the feminist performance artist. Well, I saw this, I saw a performance of hers in New York, and I was just amazed at its simple-mindedness, its capacity for emotional bribery, its, you know, the general... I didn't walk out, but I thought, my God, is this what the fuss is about? Is this what we're supposed to be defending? In my opinion, no. I mean, there is an enormous amount of soggy, pseudo-therapeutic, emotionally over-the-top, formless art, some of which is... you know, contains some elements of protestation, which doesn't necessarily make it aesthetically worthwhile. And that is being jumped on, too, along with some of the good stuff.
Now, you had a book and a TV series a few years ago called The Shock of the New. It was basically a history of the avant-garde.
Well, it was a history of modernism, and we distinguish modernism from the avant-garde.
Let me get to this point, though. That one of the points that you make in the book is that painting no longer seemed to contain the possibilities of social threat and intellectual disturbance that it once did. In other words, it was very hard to shock.
That's right.
With art. Now, let's apply that to what's happening now with performance artists like Karen Findlay, or, you know, a photographer like Robert Mapplethorpe, who isn't necessarily shocking the regular art goers, the people who always go to the performance spaces or the museums or the galleries. The people who it's really shocking are the Jesse Helms, you know, the people who are attacking the art.
Think...
So, I wonder if you think the fact that there are still people left who can be shocked, like Jesse Helms, if that in its own way has had this almost reinvigorating effect on the avant-garde, giving them confidence like, well, there's people left to be shocked.
If you believe that the primary purpose of art is to shock people, I suppose that this might be, you could argue that, but I don't believe that it is. I think, you know, the purposes of art are much wider and more profound than the mere application of electrodes to some bigot cerebellum. See, I think Findlay isn't shocking. She's boring. At least she certainly bores me. But then on the other hand, you know, I don't like that kind of, way of just spilling your guts on the table and saying, well, don't you like my warm guts? Well, then you must hate me and hate art. It's not as simple as that. But in the case of Mapplethorpe, I don't believe that you see, I don't think that Helms, Wildman and co. actually got off their prats and started creating the fuss about Mapplethorpe because they suffered some kind of aesthetic shock. They certainly were revolted by the images, but the point about the present assault upon the National Endowment for the Arts and some of the work that it subsidised, indirectly, I should add, the purpose of this assault is far beyond the art world. I mean, it is just using the state of funding of the visual arts in America, pitifully small though it is, as a kind of lever with which to carry on a much wider neoconservative agenda.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Hughes, art critic for Time magazine and author of the new book, Barcelona. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Hughes. He's an art critic for Time magazine, author of the new book, Barcelona. You grew up in Australia, and you were, I'm sure, interested in the arts when you were growing up.
Actually, I wasn't at all, and not until, I didn't even, you know, look purposively at a painting until I guess I was about 16.
Mm-hmm. Now, you write about something called the cultural cringe, the assumption that, that whatever you do in the field of writing, painting, sculpture, music, film, it's of unknown value until it's judged by people outside your society.
Until it's ratified by the so-called parent culture, absolutely. That was one of the big problems we had in Australia, and to a certain extent still do.
So you didn't know if anything was good or not unless England or America said, this is first rate.
Sure, you didn't know how to value yourself. I mean, this is one of the perennial problems for the non-mainstream artist.
As you say, there's no tyranny like the unseen masterpiece.
That's absolutely right. There was not.
Well, it makes me feel that you would really identify with artists who are women or African-American or Hispanic or gay or whatever, and who felt like outside of the mainstream culture and felt like somehow...
Identify with the good ones. I mean, there are a whole lot of gay artists, for instance, that I've written about extensively. They're not in this peculiar character of a subgroup called gay artists. There are a lot of great artists who are gay.
Right.
There are a lot of exceptionally good artists, some of them great, who are women. But, you know, it seems to me to be pointless to pretend that there are, you know, that you can base a body of criticism on the idea of there being separatist cultures in which you talk about an artist as a woman first and an artist afterwards. And incidentally, this has seemed ridiculous to quite a number of women artists that I've known too. And but I would say that I'm certainly in no sense prejudiced against people because of minority origins or so-called provincial origins. Rather, it leads me, I think, perhaps to look at their work a little more sympathetically than otherwise might.
So let me ask you, when you came to New York, and people heard your accent, and a lot of people assume you were English and not Australian.
Yeah, sure, they still do, absolutely. And then, of course, when they, you know, when I say rather grumpily, I'm Australian, not English, then they go into their Crocodile Dundee imitation. It always, you know, it never worries me, but it never stops. You know, g'day, you're going to put the shrimp on the barbie now, mate. Anyway, but still, you know, they have a fairly benign stereotype of Australians.
Now, what about in terms of your background as an art critic? Do people reach different assumptions based on whether they think or you're Australian or English?
Well, I think, you know, when they know I'm Australian, they assume that I'm going to be more, you know, chauvinistic and ostentatiously virile. That was a problem in England. It's never been a problem here. In England, the idea of an Australian art critic in the 1960s when I was there seemed almost like a contradiction in terms. You know, it's like coming across a platypus which pretends to speak Greek.
When you came to New York, what were the art trends of the time? You know, the newly popular...
In 1970?
Yeah, conceptual art, I suppose.
Conceptual art, I suppose, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was sort of going out of the... there was a lot of very good minimal art around too, you know. I mean, there were a number of minimal artists who were, you know, right at the peak of their career then.
Well, how were you responding to conceptual art? Were you interested in it?
It has always bored the pants off me.
Uh-huh. Why?
I like stuff I can look at.
Right.
I'm honestly not interested in some typewritten proposition on a wall or a row of little stones on a floor connected by string or a series of, you know, filtered down propositions from some obsolete French hack philosopher like Derrida or Lyotard. All this stuff leaves me completely cold.
So when you were establishing yourself as an art critic in America and you weren't interested in what was the kind of dominant experimental form of the time. How did that affect your ability to get started?
Oh, it didn't affect it in the least. And besides which, I was interested in some of the dominant forms of the time. I have a soft spot for minimal art. That's certainly true. And there are some minimal artists I rather admire. I think the only way that you can find a readership as a critic and maybe, you know, be of some help for others in, you know, informing their views of the culture around them is by hewing your own path. And there was no shortage of people writing in art magazines, generally fairly incomprehensibly, but nevertheless writing about the wonders of conceptual art. But, you see, a writer can only write about what he or she can write about, you know, to put it in the, you know, most obtuse terms. And so I would tend to write about stuff that I genuinely respond to. I don't think that my job was ever to be a kind of impartial Polaroid, just scooping up art movements and being the village explainer on the behalf of the art world. I don't see it that way at all. I'm a writer who, for a long time, wrote about things in the art world, and I have exactly the same liberty of choice in my subject matter as any other writer.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Robert Hughes, art critic for Time magazine and author of the new book, Barcelona. Are you somebody who thinks of yourself as loving art but not being very comfortable in the art world or not loving the art world?
Excellent question. Yes is the answer. I've always avoided the art world as a social system because I think it's the only way to keep your nose clean. If you're going to be, this entails certain losses. It means that I don't know artists as intimately as I once used to. It means that there's a lot of stuff that I'm not privy to. But you see, the wonderful thing is, and this I say after the lessons of the 80s, is that it also kept me clear of that whole harlequinade of promotion and the whole sort of system of coercive social relationships that bore in upon the critic during the period of the 80s when the American art world was being transformed into the American art industry. I like to stay off to one side. I like to look closely at what I'm going to write about. I like to have a look at other things that I'm not going to write about. But above all, I don't want to be part of the social system.
Now, when you're saying about the critic's role in the 80s, do you mean that when everybody was investing in art,
yes,
and prices were soaring, that a good review by you would mean maybe $20,000?
I don't think a good review by me would necessarily mean very much in terms of price. It might,
But this was your fear, that your reviews were going to be measured in terms of price tags.
But also, you see, there is an enormous amount of pressure if you're an art critic, particularly an art critic for a major magazine like Time. There's a lot of pressure coming from the commercial side of the art world, you know. And one wants to be free of that pressure. And unfortunately, the only way of being free of it, unless you have a truly heroic capacity for rejecting people face-to-face, is to reject them simply by not going to the openings, by not having anything to do with that side of the art world.
You've been writing art criticism for many years.
Hundreds of years.
Since the 1960s.
Yeah.
What would you say you're trying to achieve with your criticism? What kind of critic do you want to be, or are you?
I would hope that people would read my work not as an utterance about authority, but rather as an invitation to the waltz. I mean, I want, first of all, I want to communicate with a wide, non-specialist audience. And I want to keep before people's eyes that the fact that every work of art, and particularly every work that's any damn good, is saturated, rooted in history. That if we only think about the up-to-the-minute and the present day, we are castrating our memories because we don't know where to, you know, we don't have a point within which to stand to intuit our standards of quality from. It's like the problem that people have when they say, well, you know, let us throw out this supposed canon. Let us abandon the utterances of all those horrible pale penis people and hegemonic white males, and let us concentrate only on what is immediately politically relevant to our conceptions of literature. You end up as a know-nothing. You end up as an ignoramus if you do that. The whole point about dealing both with the past and the contemporary is that it gives you a knowledge of the past, gives you the means whereby you can bring contemporary experience, some of it overlooked, into the field of your discourse.
Robert Hughes, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Robert Hughes is art critic for Time magazine and author of a new book called Barcelona. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. German director Volker Schlondorf is best known for his films The Tin Drum and The Handmaid's Tale, and for the TV version of Death of a Salesman, which starred Dustin Hoffman. His new film Voyager stars Sam Shepard. Coming up, we talk with Schlondorf about taking risks with actors and May-September romances. Throughout the history of classical music, composers have dedicated works to other people. Coming up, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of works by a French composer who was obsessed with a British movie star. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to a spokesman for the U.S. Attorney's Office in Washington, the government has opened a criminal probe into the now-defunct House Bank and its check-cashing activities. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Just as lawmakers were busy poring over their records from the bank, trying to explain to constituents why so many of them had so many overdrafts, the U.S. Attorney's Office announced that a criminal probe is underway. A spokesman for the U.S. attorney wouldn't say exactly what kind of criminal conduct was under investigation, but it's been suggested that members who wrote bad checks may be in violation of IRS rules. The U.S. attorney spokesman said that the criminal probe began last fall when a General Accounting Office audit revealed that current and former House members wrote 8,331 bad checks between July 1989 and June 1990. The bank covered their bad checks with the funds of other members. The House Bank didn't pay members interest on their accounts, nor did it charge them any when they wrote bad checks. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
A day after a heated debate, Bill Clinton accused Jerry Brown of making insulting and unfair attacks last night when Brown accused Clinton of directing state business to the law firm for which his wife works. Brown said that his attacks on the Arkansas governor were mild compared to how the Republicans would go after Clinton if he becomes the Democratic presidential nominee. Clinton and Brown, along with Paul Tsongas, are campaigning in both Illinois and Michigan. Late polls indicate that Clinton has big leads in both states, with Brown threatening to overtake Tsongas in Michigan for second place. President Bush was back on the campaign trail in the Midwest again today on the eve of primaries in Illinois and Michigan. NPR's Cheryl Duvall reports.
When President Bush has sought a friendly audience in Chicago, he's returned many times to the Polish-American community here. The president made few direct references to tomorrow's primary election, but he invoked the rhetoric of challenger Pat Buchanan.
As long as I am president of the United States, recognizing that it is only the United States of America, it's only our country, that can lead for freedom and democracy, I will stay involved. I am not going to pull back into some fortress America. We are not going to forget our responsibilities to lead around the world.
President Bush is returning tonight to Washington for primary day. In Chicago, I'm Cheryl Duvall reporting.
A Pentagon spokesman says the U.S. and India will conduct joint naval exercises for the first time ever. In the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, India has been trying to improve its relations with the United States. The Soviet Union was India's major arms supplier. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up less than 1 point to close at 3,236. This is NPR News. Yugoslavia UN advanced teams are setting up bases in Croatia before some 14,000 peacekeeping troops arrive. Camps will be placed in three areas in efforts to maintain peace between Serbian and Croatian factions. More than 6,000 people have died in almost 9 months of fighting. The government of Yugoslavia has called for urgent steps to make sure the peacekeeping effort goes forward, including how to pull the Federal Army out of Croatia. The major part of the UN force is due to arrive by late April. Fighting has eased in Croatia, but has not stopped completely. Chrysler has chosen an outsider to follow Lee Iacocca as company chairman at the end of the year. Robert Eaton, who has worked for General Motors for 3 decades, will take over when Iacocca retires. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
Robert Eaton, who has run General Motors' highly profitable European operations for the past 4 years, was a surprise choice to replace Iacocca. He was named over current Chrysler president Robert Lutz, who was considered to have the inside track for the job. Iacocca introduced the 52-year-old Eaton at a news conference at Chrysler headquarters this morning.
He is a product man, first and foremost, but he also understands that the right public policies, along with the right products, are essential for the future success of this company. And, of course, of the American auto industry as a whole.
Eaton will take over Chrysler at a critical time in the company's history. The number three automaker nearly went out of business in the early 1980s. It is once again in tough financial shape, facing increasing worldwide competition. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
A transit workers' strike in Pittsburgh forced some 100,000 riders to find some other means of getting to and from work today. Talks aimed at averting a strike broke off early this morning. Some 2,700 transit workers had been on the job without a contract for more than 3 months. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. My guest, Volker Schlondorf, is one of the film directors, along with Herzog, Wenders, and Fassbinder, responsible for what was called the New German Cinema. Schlondorf studied in France in the early 60s, where he worked with several of the New Wave French directors, including Louis Malle and Alain René. In America, Schlondorf is best known for The Tin Drum, The Lost Honor of Katharina Blum, Circle of Deceit, The Handmaid's Tale, and the TV production of Death of a Salesman, which starred Dustin Hoffman. Most of Schlondorf's films are adapted from novels or plays. His new movie, Voyager, stars writer and actor Sam Shepard. It's opened in New York, Los Angeles, and Philadelphia, and will open in other cities over the next few weeks. Voyager is based on the novel Homo Faber by the late Max Frisch. I asked Schlondorf what it was about that novel that inspired him to make a film adaptation.
It was really the remembrance of a novel. I had read it 15 years ago when I decided to do it without rereading it, just on the few elements that I remembered, which is a man around 50, estranged from his wife, who is 50 now, just as he is, falls in love with a 25-year-old who, as they say, could be his daughter. And so it's this reliving your life a second time, using a second chance. That's man's privilege in a way, but it's also going to be his tragedy.
Were you going through anything in your own life that made you particularly relate to this idea of reliving your life or having a second chance or doing the same thing a second time?
Well, yes. It's for me, it's a very personal movie, which doesn't necessarily make it interesting to others, but and makes it very hard for me to talk about, because often I've been treating social and political subjects and the like, and this one was really I came to New York in 84 to do the Death of a Salesman. It was meant to be like a 3 month stay, and in that short period of work, actually it lasted almost a year, I made so many friends and I got so used to this chaos of New York City, which reflected so well maybe the inner chaos that I did stay on and stay on. I developed with great voracity lots of projects. And all of a sudden I turned around, 6 or 7 years had passed by. I didn't really work that lot. And I thought, you know, did I lose my way? Where am I at? And that's when I thought of this Homo Faber, because also he's commuting between Europe and the United States a lot, so he has this transatlantic experience. Hard for me to go more into it.
Because it gets too personal?
It gets very personal. It's a divorce from Margarete von Trotta, the filmmaker I was married to for 20 years, and it's the start of a new life that didn't work out. But it's somehow through all these tragic things in art, you can overcome things in your own life. That's the amazing thing, that indeed we tragedy, which destroys us in real life, can be enjoyable when we see it on stage or on screen.
Did you end up having a relationship with someone much younger?
All that happened. I'm very embarrassed. I'm glad this is a radio show and not a television, because you'd see me blushing. But I discovered the incredible power. I mean, we know that since Wagner, Tannhäuser, whatnot. It's such a banality, but love can indeed rejuvenate you incredibly and give you almost like a second life. And, well, if it happens two or three times in a lifetime, that's amazing. I'm not speaking of short-lived relations, but really like an overwhelming passion. And that's of course, always when man is at a loss, like this Homo Faber in Max Frisch's novel, when he doesn't get along with his external, say, with his professional life anymore. He all of a sudden then remembers, oh, wasn't there something else which I dropped when I was 25 and I decided that my work was more important than my feelings and my emotions? And all of a sudden he thinks he can turn back and sort of use this source to get a meaning into his life again. But of course, if for 25 years you've privileged your work over your feeling, that doesn't go unpunished.
This will be my last question, but the relationship broke apart?
In my own case, yes, it did, because, as I said, it doesn't go unpunished. You all of a sudden you feel you're not really ready anymore to handle feelings if you've neglected them for too long a time. But then, of course, you fall into depression, and you come out of that depression somehow a better person. I don't wish it to everybody to happen, but it really opens you up. It teaches you a certain modesty that then can lead to happiness.
My guest is German film director Volker Schlondorf. His new film Voyager stars Sam Shepard. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
My guest is film director Volker Schlondorf, and his movies include The Tin Drum, The Lost Honor of Katharina Blum. He did the production of Death of a Salesman that was shown on TV with Dustin Hoffman and John Malkovich. He directed the movie A Handmaid's Tale. His new movie is called Voyager. The main character in Voyager is played by Sam Shepard.
That's right.
who's an American actor and playwright. And I wonder what it was like to work with someone who writes so well himself.
Yeah, well, that's where the story becomes even more personal, because, this is not a story of my life, nor is it his story, Sam Shepard's. But the moment he took over the character, his personality took over almost the novel, and it may be as well now a Sam Shepard story than it was a Max Frisch novel. And we had a very well worked out screenplay by Rudi Wurlitzer, who had written it with me. But we checked it, we double checked it with Sam 2 months before we started shooting. We read the script with him for a whole week, and he gave his input, and he worked with us on the dialogues from day to day. But mostly he put in his own persona. I mean, it happened to him at moments in scenes where it was not even called for. I could see that he was choking, he was starting to cry. At other moments, he'd just turn and walk away. And I'd go over and talk to him and say, Sam, you know, what's happening? Are you all right? And he'd say, well, I just realized that I could not tolerate another loss or another separation in my life. Things like that. So it was an extremely intimate work. And Julie Delpy, the young French actress who is his partner in it, was equally caught up in this. So I think it has a deep lyrical quality because of the sincerity with which we made it. And it also makes it, of course, a very unprotected movie, because when you display with such sincerity your own feelings, you can look quite sentimental.
Do you like it as the director when actors become that emotionally involved with their character, or do you prefer a more distanced professional approach?
No, I really work to get them to that point involved. And I think that's just, I mean, very seldom happens that it works out. This was one of those great moments where, despite all the difficulty of working with Sam Shepard in the sense that he is not an easy or giving person, it always felt right to do it with him, because when, you know, the problems he was struggling with, or the sort of, I mean, he's not a professional actor. He cannot just perform any emotion the way Dustin Hoffman could, say, in The Salesman. He has a hard time to deliver. But, when he does, it has an incredible, authentic power about it.
You say you like to work with the actors to get them to that point of emotional involvement with the character they're playing. How do you do that?
Well, you got to be very open yourself. You cannot have a strong ego. You cannot dictate anything to anybody. It takes great humility. And you have to be just as open to your actors as you expect them to become. I mean, you have to, I think, establish a relationship, a friendship with them. It's very risky. It's very risky.
What's the risk?
Well, the risk is that the relationship or the friendship you establish with them may go sour. They may feel that you intrude upon, you know, their intimacy, their innermost secrets they don't want to deal with. And then you'd still have to go on shooting, and that can be very difficult.
Has that happened to you?
I think there were moments in this production where we are on the verge of it. And I know when working with Robert Duvall on Handmaid's Tale, we had a day or two where the whole thing almost blew up because we got so intimate and talking so much about our relationships with women in our lives that all of a sudden Mr. Duvall, you know, sort of blew it. You know, it's very dangerous to, you know, normally you do that with an analyst in a dark room behind closed doors. You do it in front of a camera with the whole crew around. It's dynamite you're handling.
What do you mean he blew it? What did he do?
Oh, you know, he can go into incredible tantrums, but they are like an earthquake when he goes into it. And you just all you can do is, even if it's 11 in the morning, just send everybody home. You can just not go on working and try to let it cool off and next morning start then on a sort of a neutral, as you say, professional way. Just, you know, do it, perform, and deliver.
He threw a tantrum that was related to the discussions you were having about relationships with women?
Yeah, and about how to deal with it, how to go into it. You know, he was extremely sincere in the way he tried to court this young character, Kate, in the film. And also about, well, the question of betrayal is, I mean, we all have these hidden crimes in our life, and you bring that up to include, a behavior you are ashamed of, but which is actually part of your life, and you want to use that in a performance. Well, it certainly opens up a can of not only worms but of dragons.
Can you be more specific about what happened?
I'd hate to go more into that, but I know it certainly must have touched about things that happened in his life with his previous wife and whoever he was living with at the time. you know, if actors are really sincere and authentic, very few are, and are willing to deal with that, they ask you almost to dig into that. But then when you touch the point where it is really vulnerable and painful, you know, all of a sudden they get very angry at you. And because they feel like they've given away something they don't want to give away or something they can't handle. I mean, we are very irrational people. But at the moments when we are most sincere, when we try to live a love and we don't manage it, and this is really about love lost and life wasted. Sounds terribly heavy, I'm sorry.
Well, I wonder if this whole process, because it sounds like you're really kind of playing with fire in a way, if you feel that you're becoming a more emotionally involved director, or if you're going to start leaning more toward the distanced professional approach in the future.
No, it's a come and go. No, I'm very, I mean, it's a little, you know, it's funny. I feel like I'm only starting to make movies, and yet it's 25 years since the first one. But it is just that this, human emotions and what we try to deal with in art, and mainly what is the right way to live? That's really the big question behind this. And not only from a moral point of view, but from, how can you live rightly and still achieve in society? I mean, if you follow your first instincts or whatever your first desires, you end up looking like a shit. If you adapt to society all the time, well, you get totally frustrated and you feel I've never been myself. And between these two extremes, somehow we're all looking for a way to handle it. And then things happen to us. In this case, it is really the man is caught in a series of coincidences. That's the way he calls it. Other may call it fate or destiny. Say it's emotionally, because he tries to protect himself so much, to build these dams around himself, well, sometimes those dams break, and then the flood is there, carrying away everything. And I would like to explore more and more into that direction. It is hard to catch an audience with it, but if you do, it's fantastic.
Well, Volker Schlondorf, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Volker Schlondorf's new movie is Voyager. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. We'll have Election Eve coverage from Michigan and Illinois. Linda Wertheimer is in Chicago, and she'll talk there with Don Gagne and Elizabeth Arnold. Also, she'll report from Bloomington, Illinois, on attitudes of high school students there about trade issues. Andy Bowers talks about campaign advertising from both the Republican and the Democratic side. I'll talk about the operation of the bank that members of the House of Representatives once had access to, and the way that members may have benefited financially from having complete overdraft protection. Also, NPR's Sylvia Pagioli reports from Sarajevo on the beginning of the United Nations peacekeeping efforts in Yugoslavia.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Composers, like everyone else, have their obsessions. The French composer Charles Kirkland was obsessed with the early British movie star Lillian Harvey. Some of the pieces Harvey inspired are on a recent album of Kirkland's flute music performed by Boston Symphony Orchestra flutist Fenwick Smith. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
For the past 5 or 6 years, flutist Fenwick Smith has been exploring the music of the prolific but relatively obscure French composer Charles Kirkland, who was born in Paris in 1867 and died on New Year's Day, 1951. Smith's latest album is devoted to Kirkland. The earliest piece is a sonata for piano and flute that goes back to 1913. The most recent is a complex piece from 1948 that Kirkland calls a sight-reading exercise. He was a student of Fauré, All of his music is elegant and unmistakably French. But he was also an independent spirit, and his subtle, eclectic music occasionally took some startling leaps off the deep end of rhythm and harmony. Koechlin was fascinated with that new invention, moving pictures. He wrote music for several films, including two unproduced pictures with his own screenplays. His Seven Stars Symphony has movements dedicated to Douglas Fairbanks, Greta Garbo, Clara Bow, Marlene Dietrich, Emil Jannings, Charlie Chaplin, and the glamorous British star Lillian Harvey. Besides this movement, Harvey inspired four extended series of Koechlins, two of which are included on Fenwick Smith's album. One movement from the first album de Lillian even praises Palmolive soap for maintaining Harvey's schoolgirl complexion. Harvey was evidently quite an athlete, and there are movements from his two albums de Lillian called Joy of the Outdoors, Swimming, and Skating Smiling. Here's Fenwick Smith on the flute with the charming soprano Jane West and pianist Martin Amlin in the skating movement. Alas, Koechlin's infatuation with Lillian Harvey remained unrequited. She never answered his letters or acknowledged his compositions. Koechlin even sent his wife to deliver some of his music to her, but to no avail. So maybe it's not surprising that the first album de Lillian ends with a recognition that the silver screen is only an illusion, though the power of that illusion might last forever.
Lloyd Schwartz reviewed Fenwick Smith playing music for flute by Charles Koechlin on the Hyperion label. If you have any comments about Fresh Air, call our toll-free listener line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. That's 1-800-NPR-WHYY. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, dispelling myths about the homeless. We talk with Joel Blau, author of a new book called The Visible Poor. He's a professor who used to work as a policy analyst for the New York City government. He quit after he realized the city's response to homelessness was ineffective. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.